area that we'll all be in a week or two.
You got some great Red Sox fans out here, Ned, you know.
Yeah, I know.
And they're all concerned about that trade and whatever, but we're not talking about the trade or the Red Sox necessarily right now, per se. We're talking about why you're on the air with me, and you, in your own way, play a great part in the Jimmy Fund. Would you like to spell it out for us, sir?
Well, I don't play it much, except that, as everybody knows, it's a Red Sox charity. It's the Red Sox charity, and I've been associated with the Red Sox for 20 years, and have known and seen it grown throughout those years when first I came up with Kurt Gowdy, and I didn't know what the Jimmy Fund was. And
you came up with Kurt, did you? I didn't know that.
He brought me up.
Oh, did he?
1961.
Yeah. Well, you know who brought him up, don't you?
Well,
when he was with the Yankees, you
know. Yeah, Mel Allen.
Yeah.
But I know who got him here was Mr. Yawkey.
Yes, that's correct, yeah.
No, it was a thing that I found out about when I got here with the Jimmy. There would be a month during the year when the drive was on to try to help, you know, and so many people responded, and they always do throughout New England. It's become not just a Boston or New England charity. It's become known by broadcasters and players and a lot of people throughout the whole American and National League. Baseball knows about it. The world knows about it.
Well, I'll tell you what, Ned. You don't know me, and I don't know you, sir. I've never had the privilege of meeting you. But being in the same business, as it were, I can well remember back into the old late 1940s and so forth when Jim Britt and Tom Hussey were broadcasting Red Sox baseball, and as well as Braves baseball when Boston was a two-team town, and sitting down and listening to the telegraphic recreations and, you know, out of Detroit or whatever, when you got a 14 dit-dit-dit-dies and whatever, and it was strike one type thing, when the Jimmy Fund was first incepted. And it's a marvelous charity. It goes back a long time, and it's nice to have you aboard, so to speak, as being part and parcel of that.
Well, I got I got something from the Sidney Farber Foundation just the other day.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. Talking about the progress and you know, kind of a yearly report on, and it's amazing what they have done since 19, which, you know, which is my introduction to it, and what they have, the facilities and the strides that are made, not just cancer in children, but the whole thing, the terrible thing that cancer is, and what they have done to work at it, and all the people that have worked at it.
Well, Kenny, of course, you know quite well,
sure.
Ken Coleman. This whole thing, I could give you a long dissertation here on how this all was incepted as far as Western Massachusetts go, over above and beyond being Red Sox territory, Ken Coleman. And you are both well-respected veteran broadcasters of Red Sox baseball. And it's nice to have people like you involved with that. And Kenny does a super job.
Oh, he sure does. I've known Ken well since he came here in 66, and I worked with him for 6 or 7 years until the whole station split and we all went our separate ways. But we are back now running side by side.
Okay, now, Kenny was with the Red Sox and then departed, of course, and you... How about your background? I think a lot of fans locally would like to know about your background before you came to the Red Sox.
Oh, Lord, it's been so long, dear. I forget myself. I doubt that my background is very... it has nothing to speak of it, except that I did the usual thing that radio... people trying for the radio sporting field then did. We went all over the country, from Washington, D.C. to Athens, Georgia.
How did you come to be a part of the Red Sox team, Ned? That's interesting. How did you come to be a part of that?
Oh, just by persistence and trying to bother people. I knew that once...
Sounds like me, yeah.
Athens, Georgia is where I learned how to broadcast.
Oh, you must have been happy with last night's game, then.
Oh, yeah, I was delighted.
Yeah.
I ran into a fellow down there who was in high school whose name was Francis Tarkenton. We did his games. And I also did a no-hit game that he pitched for Athens High School.
Is that right?
Yep.
Well, I'll tell you what, that's interesting as a parallel, because back in the early 60s, I was part of the Minnesota Vikings broadcasting team, and when Francis Tarkenton came out of the University of Georgia, and I worked with a fellow by the name of Ray Scott.
Yeah, I know.
Whom you probably know.
Sure.
And you and I have something in common here, where we know Francis in, you know, as a third-party type thing.
Yeah, Francis, I knew... Well, as a high school kid, and he would not know who in the devil I am now, but that's the way fame is.
Yeah, isn't that the truth? It's fleeting.
He was a three-sport athlete down there. He was basketball, baseball. In fact, he considered played shortstop and pitched And but he was just so good at football. He went to the University of Georgia, of course, and went on up to the Vikings, where you know what.
Yeah, well, the Dutch Van Brocklin. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay. Now, are you going to be aboard on the 23rd of this month with the Jimmy Fund dinner here in Northampton, or is that pure speculation?
As far as I know, I will.
Oh, you will.
Yeah.
Well, that's very good, sir. I'm sure our fans will be.
On Friday night, is it not?
Yeah, it's Friday night. Yeah. You have a dinner there on the 22nd or something, don't you?
Well, I think the writer's dinner is the
22nd. Yeah, 22nd. Yeah.
Yeah,
and you plan, at least hopefully, to tool on over, so to speak, to be here as part and parcel of our party here, so to speak, on the 23rd.
Yeah, Ken told me about that.
Yeah.
It sounds like a nice time.
Yeah, well, we're going to key on the 67 Red Sox team, which you were part and parcel of, as you probably have memories of that, of course. That was a superb year. I know where I was when the Red Sox won the pennant that day. Where were you?
Screaming in the booth.
Yeah, I know you. I tell you...
I was doing the radio broadcast. Ken and Mel Parnell were on television.
Yeah, that's right.
I was doing the radio.
Yeah.
Ken had gone down into the clubhouse in case they clinched it. Mel Parnell was finishing up on TV, and I was finishing up on radio. And then after that, the whole town broke loose, and people were climbing the screen and wondering if I was wondering if people were going to come in and inundate us in the But it was quite a day. It was, I think, a little so much more exciting than the 75 pennant, which was great.
Why so?
Well, because nobody expected them to do anything in 1967. They were a 100-to-1 shot. They were a ninth-place ball club and a bad ball club the year before. But starting to build with a few young people. And 75, at least, they'd been in contention ever since 67, you know. Eddie Casco almost had him a half game out in 72, almost won the Eastern Division.
Yeah.
If there hadn't been the strike, we had a chance to beat Detroit. So 75 was not that much of a surprise, because in 74, they talk about the Philadelphia Phillies blowing things in 64. Well, the Red Sox did it worse in 74 because they had this big lead going into Labor Day.
Right, about 12 games or so, something like that.
I mean, they were up, and they started blowing it in Minnesota, and they lost. They got shut out of a doubleheader in Baltimore on Labor Day, and from then on, it was all downhill. And a tremendous disappointment. But you knew that the talent was there. Maybe somewhere along the line, it would come into fruition. The Yankees had not surfaced yet. Baltimore was the team to beat. And Baltimore was a team that they did beat in 1975. And, of course, the 75 series, we all know, I guess, is ranks right up there with any of them.
No question, yeah.
But
yeah.
The 67 team, per se, was much more of a satisfaction, I think, to all of us, because these were a bunch of guys named Joe and a fellow named Yastrzemski and another one named Lomborg. And they all went through, and they took lightning in a bottle, and this young manager named Dick Williams, and it was just a very exciting summer, all the way from the time, from the time Billy Rohr missed the no-hitter in Yankee Stadium.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I tell you what now, you say you were in the broadcasting booth that year when the Red Sox won the pennant on the final day of the season. I can well remember being in the broadcasting booth when the Minnesota Vikings were playing that Sunday afternoon in a football game, and it seems to me, if I remember correctly, that it was a Sunday afternoon indeed when the Red Sox won the pennant that year.
Yeah.
And the Twins had 3, 4, 5 years or so, a rather good baseball team. They had Richie Rollins, you know, and Bernie Allen and Don Mincher at first base, Harmon and so forth.
Allison and
that's right. In fact, Jimmy Hall lived right next door to me, as a matter of fact.
I knew him in the minor leagues in West Virginia.
Yeah, and so who was the only one in the broadcasting booth rooting for the Red Sox, having been a Bay State expatriate, as it were, was I, you see.
Yeah.
And doing a game with Paul Gila out there at the time, a Viking football game, as a matter of fact, and I had my ear attuned to the Red Sox baseball game. And when the Red Sox won the pennant, I told Gila, I said, Gila, you take the microphone. The Red Sox just won the pennant.
Well, they beat Minnesota, then they had to wait in the clubhouse for the Tigers to lose. Otherwise,
we
were going to Detroit
the
next day, and Lee Stang, who had started to sip the champagne, Dick Williams said, Stinger, forget about it. Pocket the beer. Don't do anything until we know, because you're the pitcher tomorrow.
That was a great ball club, though. You had a guy like at third base, Joe Foy, rather, not Eddie Foy. I was going to say Eddie Foy. That's show business talk.
Yeah.
We talk about Joe Foy, who later, as you well know, Ned, went on subsequently to be in a World Series in '69 with the New York Mets. Just that bulk, that was remarkable, and I'm sure you have memories of that season. And I'll tell you what, though, as you well know, I hate ball for a long time, but there are people that have to pay for this kind of a program. And if you'll just be patient for about 120 seconds, we will have to get these commercial messages in, and we'll be right back, okay?
Okay.
Okay.
From spring through fall, we're fun. We're all that you want us to be.
We've got the spirit that Button Farms hold.
From day to night, all times, we're bright, so come join us all here.
We've got the spirit that Button Farms hold.
From Almy's to Wilco and at over 23 shops in between, you'll enjoy the Mountain Farms Mall spirit. Nice people helping you to find just what you want from hundreds of items of quality merchandise, all at family budget prices. Shop conveniently, comfortably, unlimited parking too at friendly, affordable Mountain Farms Mall, Route 9, Hadley.
Come shop, we're near. Come laugh, it's clear we're a shopping delight.
We've got the spirit at Mountain Farms Hall.
There's gold in that there lumber yard. Yep, good as gold decorated by Gold Bond. You'll find them at Kohl's Building Supply in North Amherst, where some smart people combined a sawmill, a lumber yard, and a great building supply store into one fabulously supplied outlet. Give your home a smart new look with these handsome 4x8 panels. Almond cork, daisy linen, wheat linen, or oyster weave. Available at Kohl's for just $8.95 each. Gold Bond Decorator Panels. They make any room a beautiful experience. Kohl's Building Supply is also featuring gauged all-purpose color slate tile for use under your wood stove or on the floor of your mudroom. A 10-square-foot carton, regularly $14.95, is now on special for just $9.95. Save $5 a carton. And don't forget, you can get a 40-pound bag of nut coal at just $3.97 a bag now at Kohl's Building Supply, 125 Sunderland Road, North Amherst. Stop in soon.
Okay, now we're back with Sportsline. Ned, are you there, sir?
Right.
Well, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off here, but you know somebody's got to pay for this sort of thing, as you know. 67, great season. You got had kids like Foy. I say kids, that's not true, but baseball players like Foy. He had a young man by the name of Lonberg who had an absolutely superb season that year. Darryl Brandon was part of the ball club that year. You have some memories, I'm sure. Perhaps you can recount for some of our listeners in Western Massachusetts by way of, well, nostalgia, so to speak, because it's been some 13 years or so, about some of the things that you remember from that season that are particular highlights or outstanding moments that you recall.
Well, I'll start now with the only thing I have before me. Everything else is going to be off the top of my head because I'm not very good at total recall, but I'll try.
I'm not either.
I do have the starting lineup, opening day lineup in 1967, if you'd like it.
Yeah.
Center field, Jose Tartabal.
Oh, Jose, sure, yeah.
Third base, Joe Ford, batting second.
Yeah.
Yastrzemski in left field. Tony Conigliaro, right field, batting cleanup. George Scott, first base. Reggie Smith was at second base. He's batting number six.
That's right, yeah.
Before they moved him to the outfield, Mike Andrews had come up with a bad back in spring training. Reggie Smith started at second. Rico Petroselli at short.
Mm-hmm.
Mike Ryan of Haverhill,
oh, yes.
Massachusetts. It was a catcher, and Jim Lonborg, the pitcher.
I'll tell you what, though.
Pitched the opening day and the last day.
Well, Andrews isn't a very good pool player, you know. He and I and Billy Spanswick got together and played pool here in Northampton about a month ago. And Andrews is lousy playing pool. Spanswick isn't too bad, though, you know.
Spanswick, I heard, was pretty good.
Hey, I'll tell you what, though. You know, you go back. How about recounting from 66 to 67? Now, 66 was not that auspicious a season for the Red Sox, and as a consequence, they were 100-1 shots. Why were they 100-1, Ned?
Well, because they finished ninth, and they lost 100 games in 1966. But Billy Herman, who had the team then, who was fired...
Yeah.
He had a lot of plans made, but he had a lot of things going. He had a lot of plans made for 67, which he never got a chance to put into being. I think that team, I think Dick Williams did a tremendous job, but I do think it still would have been a good team in 67 under Herman. If you give credit to any manager any time, I, that particular year, would give credit to Dick Williams as much as to anybody. As much as I would have given it to Casey Stengel in 1949 with the Yankees. Otherwise, the managers are just managers who they say win or lose ten games.
Yeah, and yet what is not is it not true that the following year that Williams was dispensed with as a manager of the Red Sox?
Well, it was in 69.
69. Okay, a year later or a year subsequent.
Yeah, 68. They thought that everybody was going to lay down and die for them, and they had a terrible year. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
Ken Harrelson, my telecasting partner, had the big year. Carl Yastrzemski won the batting title, hitting 301 or 300. What 301?
Well, 301, yeah.
And otherwise, it was the year of the pitcher. And
he could never hold Snuffy Sternweiss's bat in a rainy day in Hong Kong, you know.
Sternweiss hit 309.
Well, 309, that was the lowest average that won the American League pennant, as I recall, up until that time.
Well, they did everything for the pitcher in 1968.
Yeah.
And it showed. Denny McLain, Louis Tiant, they all had great years.
Did you have a feeling at any time during that season that this was a Red Sox year? I mean, I'm sure you must have had that little feeling inside, that whatever it's called. That
67?
This was a Red Sox year.
After the All-Star break when they won 10 straight.
Oh, you did?
Well, then they came home and they had, these zillion people at the airport. And there was an excitement that I'd never seen here. I mean, people in baseball in Boston like baseball, and people in New England like it, but there have been such terrible teams up until then. When I've been here, sixth place, fifth place, ninth place, all of a sudden they caught fire. They were winning games that they had no business winning, and they were pulling things out, and they had this looseness. They were not a tight ball. They were completely loose. Williams on down. They just went about their job, and they kept bringing games up like that game in August when they were behind 8-0 to the Angels.
Yeah, 1-9-8, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, they won 10 innings, and Jerry Adair won it with a homer.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and Jerry Adair hitting home run to win the ball game was unbelievable. You know, because Adair is a singles hitter. You know.
He was so great, though.
Yeah.
He was the catalyst that moved that team that year.
Was there a leader on that ball club, Ned? Can you put your finger on somebody that sort
only
of like a fisk? You know. Yastrzemski.
Yastrzemski, by what he did, pulled that team up by its bootstraps. There's nobody that has ever had a year, and may not have one, like he did in 1967. He did everything possible, and you take it right down to the last two games that they had to win, and he went 7-for-8. He made plays in the field. He threw out Bob Allison at second base. And
don't remind me about that one.
A big run.
Yeah.
And he did everything, and by the fact that he did it, he's not a holler guy. He doesn't go around hitting guys on the butt and saying, let's go get him, gang. He just goes out and does it, and that's the way he's always been. And that year particularly, nobody will hear like Carl Yastrzemski did in 1967. I don't care. Give me your Reggie Jacksons in October or anything else. This was all year long for a team that was really not that good.
How about pitching-wise, other than Lonberg?
And Jose Santiago.
Oh, Jose Santiago, yeah. Yeah.
Boy,
that's a name out of the past.
Don't discount what he did.
Yeah.
He was great for them that year, and Stinger came in there. Lee Stang, who's going to be the pitching coach this year, he's back. Gary Bell was a great pickup. He won 12 games for them. They came up with funny people that won. And then, of course, they had a kid named Sparky Lyle.
Yeah, Sparky,
Brett was around. Ken Brett they ran them in and out, but...
You know, if I had
it. Osinski was another fellow, a long reliever who was a tough, hard-bitten kid from Chicago.
Who was that?
Kid anymore. But he kept them in ball games during the middle innings.
Well, if I had asked a trivia question on the air, which I do every once in a while, Ned, and I would have said, who was the pitcher that came over from Cleveland and won 12 games for Boston in a 1967 pennant race that was helpful to winning the pennant, nobody would probably be able to answer that, you know. And here you talk about Gary Bell.
He was picked up about 2 or 3 weeks right after they got Adair, Chicago White Sox.
Yeah, and Adair at one time was a pretty good ball player with Baltimore, too, as you know.
Yeah, well, he had that record for errorless games.
Yes, he did,
But he came in there, and he just kind of filled in wherever they needed him. He just turned out to be just a heck of a ball player, and that was the way that whole team was. It was a destiny kind of team.
I suppose that's true. It was sort of a team that... You knew somehow deep down inside, I'm sure you did as a broadcaster with the team at that time, that this was somehow a team that was just predestined to do what they did. And it's a remarkable achievement, having come from where they were the year before. This is one of those things in sports that makes what sports is all about, I suppose. Isn't that true?
Yeah, it was such a great race, too, because there were four teams in the last week who had a chance to win it. And you don't get that much anymore.
Who was in the race at that time? Do you recall? Detroit, I know, was in there.
Well, the Tigers, the Minnesota Twins, the Chicago White Sox, and the Red Sox.
Yeah, and it came down to that last game.
It came down to the last Friday when everybody thought the White Sox were going to be in, and then Kansas City beat them in a doubleheader.
Yeah.
Kansas City Athletics then were going nowhere, and they beat two of their best pitchers, Joel Horland.
Oh, I remember him, sure.
I think Tommy John or something.
Yeah.
And,
well, Tommy, yeah, the man with the bionic arm, sure, yeah.
Sure. They beat him a doubleheader, and everything turned out right. It was just, well, when you come down into the last 3 days and four teams have a chance, you got quite a race.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what here we're going to do here, Ned. I have to break for news here very shortly. We have a five-minute newscast from 7 to 7.05, and I hope you'll be patient enough to bear with me for the next 5 minutes while we do the national coverage of news. And I really want to talk about your involvement with the dinner, which is going to be held here in Northampton on the 23rd of January, a Friday night at the Northampton Hilton. And Kenny, your running mate, so to speak, at right guard, your blocking back, as it were, is going to be here to anchor the radiothon on the 24th. But we'll talk about that after we get back from 5 minutes worth of news.
Do you want to call me back, or you want me to...
No, just hold on. We'll be back.
Okay.
Here are some facts you might not have known about the Westover Job Corps Center. 91.8% of graduates are placed. Qualified youth 16 to 21 are taught a trade from a choice of 36 courses. It offers a chance to go to college. It offers help in placement. It offers free counseling. It provides room and board, clothing, and health services. For more information, call 593-5731. The Westover Job Corps Center, 593-5731.
We can expect very, very cold weather tonight. It's going to be mostly clear, windy, and very bitter. Lows from 5 below to 5 above zero. Tomorrow, very cold, variably cloudy, and a chance of some light snow in the late afternoon or early evening. And the highs will be in the teens tomorrow evening. Clearing and bitterly cold again tomorrow night. It's 7 o'clock now. Time for news from ABC and WHMP Northampton.
From ABC News, I'm Bob Schmidt. The Iranians know what kind of a deal President Carter is prepared to offer if the 52 American hostages are let go
to implement it. The bottom line, say officials, is whether the hostages have been returned. For even if an agreement has been reached, if the hostages are not backed by January, the Reagan administration will be under no obligation to stick by the plan. As one official here at the State Department said today, Iran cannot assume the proposals we've put forward will be adopted by the Reagan team. Jack Smith, ABC News, the State Department.
No comment yet from Iran with him and not Ronald Reagan, whom the Iranians call a Satan and a political cowboy. I'll have more after this.
Ready on set.
Hi, this is Michael Landon. You know, what goes on behind the scenes is important, because if things don't work well here, they won't work well up front. Same with pictures. What's behind them can make a difference. So I get mine printed on Kodak paper. And it's always available where you see the Kodak paper sign. You can't miss it. It's the sign with that memorable face. Mine.
You're on, Mr. Landon.
Okay. Look for the Kodak paper sign when you get your pictures developed. And tell them Michael sent you.
Sears presents the semi-annual Intimate Apparel Sale. Come save 30% on just about everything for your figure. Selected natural, contour, and underwire bras. Full figure and minimizing bras. Save 30% on selected shapers. Full and half slips, nylon, and more. Now 30% off. But the sale ends soon, so hurry in now through January 19th at Sears, where America shops for value. Available in most larger Sears retail stores.
For the last 40 years, a nonpartisan organization called Freedom House has been keeping an eye on how much political freedom and civil liberties people enjoy in various countries around the world. For the last 9 years, Freedom House has published the results of its findings.